I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to John Scott, professor of political science at the University of California, Davis. We're discussing his 2020 book, Rousseau's Reader, Strategies of Persuasion and Education, from the University of Chicago Press. Scott works on the history of political thought, focusing on early modern thought from Renaissance to Enlightenment. He is the author of several books and many articles on Rousseau, Machiavelli, and other early modern thinkers. First of all, John Scott, welcome back, I should say, to the Political Theory Review.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really glad to be able to do it, Jeff.
John, I loved this book. Of course, Rousseau is very close to my heart. His picture is on the podcast image, after all. So, but your book is excellent. I mean, it's really in addition to being close readings of the text, it has an attention to all the textual details that really sort of escaped me, including the frontispieces to the each of the texts. So I'm very much looking forward to talking about all of these. But, you know, so first of all, thank you for the book and congratulations. And maybe you can say a little bit about the motivation for writing the book.
Yeah, well, thanks for those kind words. Maybe we should just stop now. the motivation for the book really has been an evolution over the course of my career. And I don't know if I want to call this my capstone, you know, work, but it felt that way when I was writing it, like I've been preparing for 30 years to write this book. I, as a matter of fact, remember, I think it must have been around 1994 or so, right when I arrived at University of Houston. In fact, I was at APSA, I believe it was in Boston, and I had breakfast with Roger Masters and Christopher Kelly, the editors of the Collected Writings of Rousseau. We were talking about Rousseau stuff, and I said, you know, I noticed certain things about the text of Émile that I think are interesting. And so is that the first time I'd ever voiced this aloud? And that was 25 years ago. And as I taught Émile over the years, in particular Émile, but other works as well, I became more and more interested in the form of the work as opposed to the substance, or how the form and substance interact. So the first time I ever wrote anything that went into the book was actually a piece for Review of Politics that became one of the chapters in very much revised form. So it was really kind of a project of love that took a long gestation.
I thought we could get into, you know, the various rhetorical strategies, mm-hmm, and the form of the work that you mention in by sort of going through the Rousseau text one by one as you do. But just so first, in terms of stage setting, I thought maybe you could sort of step back and say a little bit about Rousseau's mode of writing, which is, you know, I don't want to say unusual, because there are a number of different philosophers who write in the way that Rousseau does, with the, you know, constant use of different strategies and modes of writing, from Plato through Nietzsche, for example. Mm-hmm. But maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, why it is that you consider him to be engaged in the kind of writing that he does, and, you know, some kind of general ways in which to characterize that mode of writing.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, like many people, I was drawn to Rousseau largely because of his rhetorical literary qualities, much as I'm drawn, like you, to Plato and Nietzsche, for example. I'm much less drawn to, say, Kant or Rawls, for several reasons, but among them, I just don't find them the kind of pleasure in reading them. So it really began as kind of an aesthetic matter for me. But as I, you know, have taught him over the years and read him over the years, one thing that really struck me, and this happened actually in the very first graduate seminar I taught on Émile, one of the students said, you know, I get the feeling that although it looks like Émile's the student in the work, the real student in the work is the reader. And that's just struck me as being so right. And once I started thinking about that more seriously, Émile in particular, that's really where the heart of my book and my interest began. Emile in particular, all of a sudden becomes a completely different work when you think of it not as a treatise on education, as it's typically read, but rather as an education of the reader. And then as I thought about the education of the reader more broadly, I thought, well, why does Rousseau feel such a need to educate the reader and to use these different rhetorical and literary techniques to do so in his writing? And it seemed to me that the answer was that he's trying to get us to look at the world in a different way. That the way he's discussing human nature, for example, or social institutions, is meant to sort of shock us away from taking those things for granted as we see them, and to see something in a different way. So in other words, I think his writing, not just in Emile, but maybe across all of his works, as being fundamentally educational, and in that sense, persuasive, rhetorical. But the educational aspect of it was what really grabbed me.
I thought that you maybe could say a little bit about the theories of reader response that you take on, because another route into this is via, you know, just sort of literary criticism that, because it hasn't gone on remarked some of the things that you've said. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you could say a little bit about how, you know, the kind of background framing for thinking about how, you know, to think about the reader in the context of, you know, Rousseau's work, how he constructs the idea of a reader, or how, right. you know, we right. can think about thinking of our own experience in the context of reading Rousseau.
Yeah, as you're, you know, sort of alluding to the fact that in the introduction to the work, I take up reader response theory and other literary critical methods or movements as a way of thinking about Rousseau in a somewhat different way than we might think of him ordinarily, let's say. And in this sense, what I was interested in is, so I do think Rousseau is a philosopher. I think that Rousseau is after the truth and after trying to tell us what he thinks the truth is. So he's a philosopher. But he's certainly a philosopher who resorts to rhetorical, and some people think that's a bad word, rhetorical, when talking about Rousseau, methods. And so usually if we think about texts, philosophy texts, we often at least think about them as being really there's no author reader relationship other than me explaining to you, you know, that X plus Y equals Z or something like this. So there's not a resort to rhetoric. There's not a resort to literary things, at least as an essential element of it. Now, obviously, that's not true of all philosophy. You can't read Plato's dialogues, although people have tried without attending to the form of the work, the rhetoric, the characters, etc. But I think, you know, there's a typical notion that it doesn't matter who the author and the reader really are. They're sort of, you know, in a way abstract. But if you think about a literary work, there's an author and there's a reader, and the author is trying to do things to the reader, to get the reader to feel certain ways, to see certain things, to empathize with characters, et cetera, et cetera. So when I started thinking about the author-reader relationship in Rousseau, I realized that sort of a lot of the typical tools, let's say, that we would think of in terms of philosophy were not going to be adequate for what I wanted to do. So I kind of stabbed around, and it was really Stanley Fish. Stanley Fish's book on Milton, Surprised by Sin, that got me down that road. So Milton, or Fish's argument, is that Milton is trying to get you, the reader, through the poem, Paradise Lost, to be surprised by your own sinfulness. And he uses all kinds of techniques and rhetorical and literary, et cetera, poetic, in this case, to do so. And I thought, wow, Rousseau is like that, except he's surprised by not sin, but goodness. He wants us to get to see our natural goodness. And he's using this author-reader relationship of challenging the reader, surprising the reader, yelling at the reader oftentimes to do this. And so I started reading more literary critical works, largely in the reader response theory, in order to help me think through how I could approach the text. But that said, it is a philosophical text as well that I'm dealing with. So I kind of had to have a hybrid method of literary and philosophical analysis.
Let me try this one for a size, because this occurred to me in reading your text, to tell me what you think of this. Because yeah, in some ways, when you're thinking about rhetoric in the history of political thought, right, there's a way of thinking about rhetoric where you kind of make a discourse or a dialogue a little prettier than it would otherwise be. It's an appeal to an aesthetic sort of improvement of the text. But what you're talking about here, it seems to me, is to be, you know, having to do with the rhetorical strategy of sort of conveying individualized experience, right? It's an experiential, you know, kind of feeling with rather than a kind of cognitive relationship. And so this is I think this is the heart of the, you know, the reader author relationship as you're describing it here, that Rousseau is sort of engaged in trying to convey, paint a picture, as it were, of an individual experience, which you wouldn't otherwise be able to do with the sort of abstract philosophical cognitive approach. Is that, you know, is that on the right track, the sort of experiential character to the text here?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I, you know, that's one reason why I began the book, or near the beginning of the book, with his description of the moment when he became Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the so-called illumination of Vincennes. So he's on the way to visit Diderot in the Chateau de Vincennes, where he's imprisoned. He takes along his Mercure de France, sits down under a tree, allegedly, and reads the prize essay competition for the first discourse. And the way he describes it is, if I could convey what I saw and felt in that moment, then I would transform how we see the world. And that's what I've tried to do in my work. So to convey what I felt and saw. And that's what I think he's trying to do through this author-reader relationship, rhetoric, et cetera. And he consistently uses, for example, visual metaphors of seeing the world in a different way throughout the works. The feeling part's a little harder to get your hands around. And of course, and this would be a critic of Rousseau, would say, well, feeling is not thinking. So, you know, feeling is very individual. Feeling is subjective. And that's not what philosophy is about. But I would say that when Rousseau says he's going to convey what he felt and saw under that tree, it's not inconsistent with philosophy. And in fact, in order to provoke or educate his reader, he has to convert the reader in terms of the reader's feelings, sentiments, as well as vision about the world.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I take it this points towards a really deep point about Rousseau's philosophy as such, that it's not cognitivist at bottom. That is, that, you know, the truth claims that he, maybe, I don't know if you agree with this, but, you know, the truth claims that he makes are not sort of verified by pure reason, as it were, right? But that there's a sort of emotive, emotional, or experiential character at bottom. I mean, I think of this in the context of, you know, the sort of self-reflexive character of all of Rousseau's texts, which you bring out really well. Mm-hmm. And the thing that you add here, which is this, it's not only self-reflexive, but it's self-reflexive about Rousseau's relationship to a reader, right? Which points to the, you know, inescapably dialogic character of human experience in Rousseau's view. I mean, there's no privileged place, in other words, you know, that pure reason can sort of access the truth. You always have to go through human experience, which is always mediated by the relationship with the other, right? So there's no way to write other than this way. I mean, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. And this is, you know, you get that creepy sort of, how do we get to the edge of where philosophy stops and experience begins, or subjective experience begins? And I think Rousseau kind of toes along that line. And I would say, you use the word dialogic, which I would agree with. Another word we might use, I suppose, is phenomenological. Rousseau's thought and expression of it is phenomenological. And part of the phenomenological aspect of it is him to get you, the reader, to experience the world and yourself in a way that he is trying to get you to do. The status of the truth claims that he makes are controversial. I think one of the main issues that he gets at all over his works is the difference between nature and artifice. So if we are indeed beings who are both natural and artificial, which, you know, Plato, Aristotle on would argue that that is the case, but for Rousseau in a different kind of way, then by the time we actually use discursive reasoning, for example, to try and understand ourselves or the world, we're already in a world of artifice. So how in the world do we peel away the artifice, including the artifice of our own, you know, souls, in order to get to something that's natural? Or what does it that even mean for it to be natural? So if we're beings that are by our nature part artifice, how do we separate the two? I think he's constantly trying to do that. And so the truth claims he wants to make about nature, for example, the natural goodness of man, I think he believes that is true. But it's not obvious or immediate in our experience, to say the least. And so I think he's involved in a very difficult, he's chosen a very difficult position to try and defend and articulate.
I thought maybe you could say a little bit about some of the general ways in which Rousseau relates to the reader, because it's not always charming the reader, as it were. There's also kind of challenges and tests that Rousseau has along the way in the text, that there's the way you put it, is sort of agonistic relationship at some points, in addition to a, you know, sort of collaborative relationship. So, I mean, could you say a little bit about some of the general strategies and how Rousseau relates to the reader?
Sure. And I think you're right. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you think about the experience of people who read Rousseau, students, for example. And in my experience, at least, there are a group of students who are sort of seduced by him. They're seduced by the portrayal of natural goodness, or seduced by various aspects of his writing. And on the other hand, there are students who are repelled by him. And I myself have had both reactions over time to Rousseau. And I don't think that's accidental, that the way he, as you mentioned, he interacts with the reader, and this is particularly true in Emile, but it's true in Julie and other writings as well, he goes back and forth between collaborative or seductive on the one hand, on the other hand, antagonistic and challenging on the other. That was one of the first things I got me going down this path, was reading, again, Emile's the one that, for me, reading Emile, and how many times he basically accuses the reader of not understanding him. He accuses the reader of making mistakes, of, for example, making mistakes about what's natural. An example in Emile, you see a baby crying. Actually, Rousseau claims this is himself as witness to the scene. You see a baby crying and gets slapped, and then the baby shuts up and then roars in anger. But Rousseau argues that anger is not natural. So already we're making a mistake about attributing motives and feelings to the child that aren't natural. So he in this case, he accuses himself of making a mistake, but oftentimes in the work, he'll just pause and say, you know, if you're asking this question, you should just stop reading right now because you don't understand me. Or I only write for people who don't need to be told everything. And part of that challenge could, of course, be repelling. Okay, I'm going to put the book down, Rousseau. Yeah, I'm annoyed with you. Or it could be a challenge like, hey, wait a minute. You know, I want to prove myself to you, the author, Rousseau, that I do understand something. So there's a kind of conversion moment, not only in seduction, but potentially in accusation as well. So in terms of that kind of interaction as a literary technique. But then there are other literary techniques that he uses. Like I mentioned before, constant reference to visual perspective of seeing things one way or seeing them other and correcting that vision. So he's constantly coming back to those visual metaphors and using them in his writing, for example.
The last thing I wanted to ask in terms of, by way of introduction, is to ask you to sketch briefly the thematic thread that you have here about Rousseau's relationship to Plato's Phaedrus, particularly challenge to writing as such that Socrates lays out in that dialogue that I was surprised to see. I don't know how I'd noticed this before, but you brought it out really well, how Rousseau is engaged in a sustained dialogue with this dialogue, particularly on this point. Could you say a bit about it?
Yeah, that was a real kind of key for me to unlocking a thread that ran through the book and my reading of Rousseau across the different works. It's been known, of course, for a long time that he refers to the Phaedrus and the question of the utility or lack of utility of writing, and the problem of writing can't be adapted to the character or needs of a reader in the way that a speech could be adapted to the character and needs of an auditor, for example. So that speech is a superior manner of educating, persuading, and such compared to writing. So he makes a reference to the Phaedrus in the first discourse. People have known that for a long time. The frontispiece to the first discourse of Prometheus alludes to that same bringing arts to man, in this case, writing. So that's been known a long time. What I was struck by was it appears all over Rousseau's work, both in thematically, but also literally referring to the Phaedrus myth in various places, and including in Émile. So for example, in Émile, when he turns to the question of teaching Émile to read and read books, Rousseau goes on a diatribe against books. They're useless books, but of course he's saying that in a book, just as in Phaedrus, Plato is writing about the problems of writing in a writing. So you might say that Plato tries to solve this problem in his writings by making them dialogic. They're not didactic, they're dialogic. So you have different characters with different needs, and Socrates or others interact with them differently depending on their characters and their needs, for example. So there's a way in which the rhetorical situation gets built into the writing itself. What I was struck with Rousseau is that he's very much doing the same thing, trying to meet the challenge of how do you appropriately engage different readers, and that he himself is trying to, through techniques, literary techniques, rhetorical moves, and so on and so forth, to similarly, within writing, overcome the limitations of writing. And that's not true, I wouldn't say, universally across his writing. So, for example, The Social Contract has very little of that sort of flavor to it. But First Discourse and Émile in particular do, Second Discourse does. If I'd extended my analysis to Julie or to his autobiographical writings, which I welcome someone to do, but I just, too much for me to do, but I think it would be present there as well.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's particularly difficult to anticipate all the different readers that one might have to a written work, because written works last much longer than speeches do. So this is a particular challenge that Rousseau takes up. I thought we could talk about the First Discourse, which is the subject of your first substantive chapter. And maybe you could take up this point about how Rousseau is essentially speaking to a couple different readers or a couple different audiences, I guess I should say, because as you point out, the discourse was read to the prize committee that it famously won the prize from. And that text, essentially, that discourse that was read is different in important ways, as you point out, from the written text that the rest of us read. And so you argue that, you know, this you know, points towards a couple different kinds of readers and a couple different kinds of experiences. So maybe you could sort of just sketch that argument and, you know, what the significance of the different types of readers are.
Sure. I was building in part upon, Leo Strauss, but more particularly Roger Masters in certain respects, where Masters, for example, argues that Rousseau takes two different poses in the first discourse. One is as a philosopher or scientist, and the other as a common man or citizen. And he has two addressees, his fellow philosophers or scientists, and his fellow common men. And Rousseau has different messages for each of these audiences. To the common men, like himself, he claims, he says, you know, leave that science and art stuff alone. That, you know, it's corrupting, you know, be good citizens, be good people. To his fellow philosophers or scientists, he says, go ahead, pursue philosophy and science, but don't make it into a public affair. Don't try and popularize philosophy or science. Of course, that's a root attack against the encyclopedia and the Enlightenment there. So they made those arguments, and that leads to certain sort of esoteric, exoteric type considerations for the first discourse. I frankly wanted to avoid that. I am not interested in an esoteric or exoteric interpretation of Rousseau or the first discourse in particular. What I was more struck by, I'd read the first discourse for years, and it never occurred to me that the written text that was submitted and read at the Academy was different from the version we have. I mean, I knew that, but I never really thought about it. But once you start looking at the work that way, you realize that there are certain things that are available to the reader of the published version of it that were not available to the initial auditors of the prize essay. Just to take one example, the frontispiece is not available. So Prometheus bringing fire to man and warning Satyr not to touch it, that's not available to the judges. Similarly, the note that refers to the frontispiece at the very beginning of the second part of the first discourse, where he reveals that he's referring to Phaedrus and the problem of utility of writing versus speech, that note is not available to the judges. And so in other words, the whole question of different kinds of readers is not available in any direct or obvious way without those elements that he added for the printed version. So all the considerations I was interested in of how does he write for different kinds of readers were in essence absent from the initial prize essay.
Maybe you could sort of walk through that the frontispiece, or maybe another example, whichever one you want to take up, to sort of bring out what the significance of the difference there is between the two different audiences for, I don't want to say readers, because they the prize essay committee were auditors, but
someone what had to read it.
That's true, right? But what significant, you know, like the substantive significance, I guess you could say, of the difference here would be.
Well, I think first of all, the thinking about the written versus the spoken version corroborates something about Roger Masters or Leo Strauss's interpretation, but coming at it from a different kind of direction, coming at it from the experience of being a reader as opposed to some sort of position about philosophy and, you know, city and man and esoteric and exoteric and so on, which I again kind of stay away from for a number of reasons. But I think that my reading corroborates a lot of the aspects that they have. So I don't want to claim to be more original than I am. But I think to the so let me tie this approach to the substance of the work of the argument of the first discourse. So in this chapter, I, in revised version, adapt something I published before with my former students, Sally Campbell, on the first discourse, having to do with what is the actual argument of the first discourse. So I pilfered that from the earlier publication, but put into a different frame, namely this reader, read versus spoken work framework, and the notion of the sort of form of the discourse with the various elements of the frontispiece and the preface and the notes, et cetera, that were added to the published version. And the basic argument there is there's an apparent argument of the first discourse, and then there's an actual argument, or I can't remember the term I actually used, of the work. Namely, the work seems to argue that the sciences and arts, or the advancement of the sciences and arts more accurately, corrupts morals. Our argument, and then my argument within this chapter, is in fact, when you look at it more carefully, Rousseau's argument is much more complex, and to make it simplified at least, actually it's the other way around, that the corruption of morals leads to the advancement of the science and arts. More particularly, the corruption of morals are connected with inequality, and therefore with political, economic, and social matters that Rousseau hides or obscures in the text of the work. So if you're a reader who comes at the work as a sort of first appearance, you take away what everyone takes away, the sciences and arts, corrupt morals. But a more careful reading reveals that the argument is more complex. So part of that has to do with the reading experience. I didn't specifically argue that that wouldn't be available in the spoken version of the work as compared to the written work. But I would say that these elements of the complexity argument become more apparent when you attend to the difference between the spoken form of the work versus the written.
Right. And certainly one of the points you make is about the preceptors of the human race, as he points out, Socrates and Cato and other individuals who appear more, you know, closer to the end of the first discourse, that by, you know, attending to these characters and their significance, you can get a sort of fuller understanding of the discourse itself. So it's a kind of test for the reader to sort of test how much they know. Again, reminds me of Nietzsche and the ways in which, you know, Nietzsche is engaged in the kinds of tests to determine who's a good, careful reader and who isn't.
I think, by the way, what you just said about the preceptors of the human race passage being a test of the reader, I wish I'd said that. that's I think correct, because usually happens is you're like, he's condemned science, he's condemned philosophy, and then you get to the end of the work and he says, oh, but let scientists of the, you know, philosophers of the caliber of Bacon, Newton, Descartes pursue philosophy. It's the greatest achievement of the human mind. You go, what? So most people read that and think Rousseau's contradicted himself. But I think that there's a challenge. We go, how could that be true on the one hand? And on the other hand, it'd be true that science and arts corrupt morals. So that challenge then makes you go back and reread the work.
So the second discourse is considerably longer than the first discourse. And I found that some of what you said is sort of amusing about how it reminded me about how, you know, it's at one point the prize essay committee for the second discourse, you know, they just stopped reading it when they realized how long it was.
Yeah.
Yes, but so there's a way in which Rousseau a little bit overdid it here in the second discourse. But I think we can talk a little bit about, you know, some of the elements in the second discourse, what you call the paratextual apparatus, which we talked a little bit about in the case of the first discourse, especially the frontispiece. But there are other sort of textual apparati at the beginning of these things, like the exordium to the the prize committee, and, you know, in the second discourse, it's particularly ornate, right? There's like a letter, and there's a preface, and there's various other things. I think you point out that, isn't it that, you know, the paratextual apparatus is half the length of the whole thing? Is that, did I have that right? I think it's
the length here.
Yeah, it's amazing.
In the notes, I mean, I guess by part of the bulk of that,
right. Yeah, you include the notes. It's so yeah, I thought we could talk about some of these elements. Maybe we could start, I mean, because the frontispiece is to Rousseau's text play a large role in your book. You could start by describing the frontispiece, the second discourse, and talk a little bit about what you take from it.
Sure. And by the way, the paratextual elements, I'm stealing that from someone else, a literary critic. Jeanette, actually, that's a translation of his term. His term is sid, which means thresholds. So thresholds of texts, and it got translated as paratexts into English. And so the idea there being that there are oftentimes elements to a text that have that are, so to speak, added to the text itself. And that could be footnotes, that could be introductions, that could be indices, could be illustrations, and so on. So, I tend to the form of the work that I examine, the first discourse, second discourse, Emile, and Social Contract, with particular attention to what are these paratextual elements doing. So the frontispiece, the second discourse, shows a, half-clothed, we'll say savage in a, since that's the word Rousseau uses, a half-clothed savage tossing away his European finery, with witnesses being the Europeans themselves watching him do this, and says he's going back to his equals, which means the Hottentots in this case, who are barely visible in the illustration itself, but over to the right, whereas the Europeans are to the left. So you seem to see this being savage, who's half civilized, half savage, standing between civilization and savagery or barbarism or primitivism or whatever term we want to use. Of course, Rousseau doesn't think those are pejorative terms. And he's going to go back to his equals, as opposed to, we presume, the inequalities of these civilized people. So there you have it. It's fairly obvious. You don't need a lot of decoding to figure out, the basics of that illustration. What I think is interesting, though, is the fact that on the frontispiece itself, Rousseau puts a note telling you to go look at a note. And interestingly about this note, I think, is also the fact that later on in another paratextual element, once you start reading the work, the notice on the notes, Rousseau tells you, don't read the notes. So here you have a note on the front of the thing sending you to the note. It's already a test of what kind of reader are you. I look at the pretty picture, turn the page, start reading, or do I go to the note? And in the note, he tells the story it's being depicted. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It just sounded a little different. So if you go to the note that he references, he tells the story that's being depicted there. And just to use one small element there, it's revealed in the note, in the quotation from a travel account that Rousseau's using, that the Hottentot also rejects Christianity, the religion of the civilized people, which is not evident in the frontispiece itself. So you get a sense there of the depth of Rousseau's criticism in the discourse on inequality that you wouldn't get if you didn't pursue that looking at the note.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm looking at the frontispiece right now. I mean, what's in a way striking about it is just as a sort of visual construction of it, there's almost like, it's very cluttered on the left side of the page, right? So you have the governor who's seated and there are a bunch of Europeans around him. I mean, first of all, I'm curious as your view, why there are a bunch of, European, why Rousseau has a bunch of guys. Why is the governor seated? Why are there a bunch of guys behind him? But there's also like just the composition of the piece. It's very cluttered on the left and very open and sort of airy and free on the right, I guess you could say. Maybe the interpretation of that is a little bit bit clearer, but I don't know if you want to speak to any of those elements.
Yeah, I haven't thought of much about the cluttered versus open, except that the composition of it naturally leads you to read from the top left to the bottom right, which is in fact the pose of the Hottentot throwing his clothes down. So it does lead you from one side to the other. So I assume that that was the general idea. I should note something I say in the book, but Rousseau was apprenticed to an engraver from whom he ran away at age 15. But in Geneva, he was apprenticed to an engraver. So he knew a lot about engraving. And I think we have this vision of Rousseau, the sort of solitary walker, you know, wandering through the woods and looking at flowers. But if you read his correspondence with the publishers, oh my God, was he a nightmare to deal with? He was so picky and constantly sending stuff back and, you know, you've screwed it up and everything else. And among the things we know is he was very involved in the design of the engravings, gave very specific instructions to the designer and to the engraver, and he was almost never pleased with them either in the result. So in other words, I think we can safely say we can interpret the illustrations, that they're not super added to the work, for example.
Maybe shifting over to the notes, the notice on the notes, mm-hmm. because as you point out, quite an odd feature of the second discourse. You know, so what is he on about here? I mean, so he tells us not to read it. They're not, what is he saying? They're not that important. I don't even
remember now. Not good to read with the text.
Right. And, you know, it seems so strange. These notes sometimes stray far enough from the subject. They are not good to read with the text. I've therefore relegated them to the end of the discourse in which I have tried my best to follow the straightest path. So there's a sort of visual metaphor mm-hmm. there, right? So those who have the courage to start over again will be able to amuse themselves. I love the amusement element there. To the second time with beating the bushes and to try to peruse the notes. And there will be little harm to others in not reading them at all. As I recall from, you know, your discussion of this, it's a little bit of a challenge to the reader. I mean, I found your suggestion also that, you know, the bulk of the notes are in the first part and kind of, mm-hmm. if you do attend to the notes closely, it slows you down in the natural goodness of man part, which is quite interesting. Anyway, you could say, you know, I mean, what's going on here? Why does he have this notice and what does it mean?
Yeah, well, of course, he's impish. I think, and it's peculiar, just the placement of the notice in the notes, right? It comes, you would expect that to be on page one. You know, page one, there are notes, don't read them. That would still be weird. But the fact that he has the notice on the notes after the frontispiece, of course, and title page, but after the dedication to Geneva, and then after the preface to the work, which is an extra not submitted with the essay part again, and then before you begin the work proper, that's a weird placement, especially since he's already given you two notes to read, plus referring you to the frontispiece. If you've been diligent and read those two notes he refers you to, you've already violated his command not to read them. So it's very peculiarly placed. And I've known that for a long time. The notes have interested me for a long time out of a simple experience of being a teacher. Namely, how do you get the students to read the notes? Do you tell them not to read the notes? You tell them no, despite the fact he tells you not to, you should? Do you have them read some of the notes but not the others? And will they actually do it? And it also comes to me, my interest in it, from the perspective of a reader. So the text, the translation that I grew up on, so to speak, with the second discourse was Roger Masters' translations, first and second discourses. And so Roger, you know, you have the main text, then you have Roger's editorial notes in the back of the work, and you have Rousseau's notes in the back of the work too. So I find myself with like three fingers, right? Trying to read this thing, flipping back and forth being, you know, this is really aggravating. So in my own edition, I put the footnotes at the bottom and gave page numbers for the Rousseau's notes, which of course violates the spirit of the whole thing, but I thought it was just an easier reading experience. So it was an experience of a reader being frustrated with flipping back and forth to notes, got me thinking, what's Rousseau doing by including these notes and doing it the way he does? And matters get worse if you look at the original edition of the Discourse on Inequality, which Heinrich Meyer is to be congratulated for. Namely, the notes aren't even in order. So he doesn't number them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or A, B, C, D, E. Rather, he uses three different systems of numbering the notes. So if your experience of reading the notes is already frustrating now, just imagine there. You know, you don't know where you're going. You're having to flip through, where's note A? And again, they're not in order, and they use different systems in the original. So in other words, Rousseau seems to be intentionally making your reading experience frustrating. You really have to be a courageous reader, as he says in Notes on the Notes, in order to keep doing it. So again, that made me think, well, think more about something I think is obvious from the Notice on the Notes itself. Namely, Rousseau's saying there are kind of two kinds of readers, lazy or cowardly readers and courageous readers, are already sorting you into different lines, so to speak, of readers. So, but I think that the attending to the sort of more physical attributes, I'll call it, of the notes just compounds that challenge.
Yeah, I wonder what you make of the, you know, the straightest path versus the beating of the bushes. I mean, struck by that metaphor in the sense that, I mean, in some ways, straightest path is a good path. I mean, it's the clear path towards the truth, and beating of the bushes might be distraction. You're sort of heading off the path. But another way, I suppose, you know, beating of the bushes, you may discover a different path, or you may get some more complete picture of the forest than you would otherwise just by following the well-trodden ground.
No, that's right. And so in terms of scholarly attention to the notes, you know, first of all, a lot of scholars just basically ignore the notes or ignore their status as notes and quote freely from them or whatever. That's all well and good, I suppose. But the scholars who have thought about the notes basically have come to two seemingly contradictory conclusions. So Roger Masters concludes that the notes are primarily, at least, meant to provide scientific evidence that could prove the actual possibility of Rousseau's account of the state of nature and human development. I've never found that to be particularly compelling. Whereas Richard Velkley, another person who's looked at the notes, argues that in fact the notes undermine his portrait of natural man and his development. So they seem to be polar opposite conclusions about what the notes are doing. So as I puzzled over that question, what I came to realize, I think, or at least I argue, is they're both right about this. But the key point is this, that particularly in the first part of the discourse, which has most of the notes, as you mentioned, particularly in the first part of the discourse, it's meant to be timeless, right? Natural man sitting under the tree, his needs are satisfied. Next day, sitting under the tree, needs are satisfied. Next day, maybe he makes a little discovery, but he can't communicate to anyone, so he sits down under the tree. Next day, under the tree. So there's a sort of static element to Rousseau's description. The human race need never have developed. It could always be sitting under that tree. And what the notes do, in my view, is in different ways, they disrupt that static character. They suggest that there could have been development prior to the stage that Rousseau starts at there, which would be Master's argument. On the other hand, there could be developments in that stage that start to, because of perfectibility, we could discover things, we could invent things, even language. Rousseau admits that languages existed in the state of nature between a mother and child. His argument is they weren't sufficiently stable or long term to become languages proper. But that's an example where the timelessness that he seems to want to portray, the static character, is disrupted. And that oftentimes happens in the notes. So in other words, the straightest path, to use the term that you've fixated on, the straightest path is in fact a kind of fiction. Rousseau is willing to admit that the straightest path is a simplified path, that his account of the state of nature, for example, is simplified, and the notes disrupt that simplification.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because as you develop in the argument about it, you point out how that, you know, the fictional version, or the idealized version, I guess you could say, he uses these sort of this vivid imagery of the, you know, as you say, that, you know, the natural man sitting under a tree or locked in combat with whatever animal or, you know, and so forth. So that there, even though there's, you know, a timeless, abstract, idealistic character to it, he uses this visual imagery in order to make the experience vivid and real, in contrast to the notes, where he activates, rather than that sort of visual character, more of a scientific cognitive sort of analysis of it. I don't know if you want to say any more about the sort of visual imagery and the you know, how he develops the argument in the first part of the second discourse.
Well, I'll just say one thing, I guess, at least, that sort of prepares for talking about Emile as well. Well, first of all, as you know from reading the book, I concentrate on the first part of the second discourse. I briefly talk about the second part of it, but it's just too much to deal with. But my main point in focusing on the first discourse was that Rousseau wants to persuade you that his account of natural man sitting under that tree is possible, or maybe even true, but at any rate, at least possible. And the problem is, when we look at our fellow human beings, we don't ordinarily see them sitting under a tree by themselves with all their needs satisfied. We see them be social animals, for example. And so Rousseau needs to try to show you that the animal you think is the human animal, the social animal with speech and reason, et cetera, is not in fact natural. That being is artificial or developed from a natural beginning. But in other words, his account of natural man goes against your ordinary experience, or what you ordinarily see, to use visual imagery. So what I suggest is Rousseau himself uses visual imagery in the first part in order to sort of establish your sight, right? Establish your vision of natural man. So we begin with him sitting under that tree. And although he's in motion, satisfying his primitive needs, fighting animals, you know, gathering acorns or whatever, fundamentally, he's sitting under the tree. And one way that Rousseau does this, I suggest, is he starts introducing portraits, little mini sketches of natural man in comparison to civilized man. And you alluded to to fighting. There's this one place early on in his account, in the first discourse, where he says, imagine natural man having a fight with civil man. Well, civil man's got all his stuff. And so he can beat natural man with his, you know, guns and armor and whatever else he has. But if you stripped civil man bare and didn't let him have this stuff, natural man would kick his butt. And so what I find funny, you know, as you read that passage, you find yourself rooting for natural man. Come on, natural man, you know, you can beat civil man. And so somehow that experience of visualizing them in comparison makes natural man more real. At least that's what I suggest Rousseau is trying to do. So he's using these visual images to establish a kind of portrait of natural man, and then to define it in comparison to comparisons with civilized men.
Yeah, good. So let's shift over to the Emile, which characterizes the bulk of the book. You have four chapters on the Emile, in fact. And it does repay a lot of attention. I mean, there's just so many details here that are quite striking. I mean, to begin where you begin, which is in the first chapter about the education of the reader in Emile, this is the point that you made before about that primarily it's an the text is about an education for the reader, not necessarily an educational treatise. And I thought we could start with the genre of it, and because it's a kind of a mixed genre or an odd genre in the sense that it's a novel and a kind of treatise mashed together. And it'd be helpful, because I didn't realize this, that there's there was an earlier draft of the Emile in which Emile as a character doesn't even appear until much later in the book. So you could say a little bit about that, and then why, in your view, he sort of chose this genre in order to effectuate this aim of educating the reader.
Right. And yeah, it is a strange work format. And I mean, I can't think of another, work of philosophy that looks like this. Maybe there is one, but I don't know what it is. And certainly unlike his actual novel, Julie, which is a novel, this has a different, more treatise-like form, but borrows some of the same novelistic type techniques as in Julie. Well, I must say that I don't find Emile to be a particularly compelling character in the work. And the more compelling character is the tutor, who, of course, is none other than Jean-Jacques himself. So Rousseau doubles himself. He's the author of the work. He's the tutor. And then there's a series of interactions between the author and the tutor, so to speak, that we see. We see interactions with Emile. We see other pupils and stories about other pupils. So he takes advantage of the kind of storytelling, not just Emile, but in general, to, I think, again, kind of fix our visual point of reference here and to seduce us or persuade us away from thinking that human nature as we observe it, for example, in children, is actually human nature. What we're witnessing is not nature, but artifice. So Emile, as some quote-unquote natural man, becomes a visual point of reference for judging how we see things. So I think the novelistic aspects of it are meant to make that more persuasive and pervasive than a simple treatise would have done. And as you remark, in the first version, which we have in manuscript, Emile doesn't come into the picture until very late. I think basically in book, most of the way through book two, so almost a considerable way through the text. And so I think obviously Rousseau seemed to have all of a sudden thought of using the more novelistic aspects, giving himself an imaginary pupil and making himself an imaginary tutor. He self-consciously recrafted the book to do that. And so I was interested in seeing, well, how does he do that? And what is the intended effect, at least as I'm able to understand it?
Yeah, so in a way he serves as a, that was a helpful point. I mean, he serves as a kind of benchmark or standard to evaluate the reader's own progress or the reader's own educational efforts. It would be very different if you just had a straight up treatise and Rousseau is just telling you one principle after another about how to raise your child. It would be quite different, right? I mean, you would have these kinds of, again, rational abstract principles, but you wouldn't have the sort of enfleshed or embodied, individual in front of you that sort of combines all these together into the individualized person that it is. Of course, it's an individual, idealized, individualized person, which is the kind of trick that Rousseau uses all along, but.
No, right. I kind of wish he had written that treatise because, I've spent some amount of my career trying to basically excavate his philosophical position on human nature or psychology and, the complication that comes with him intermixing it with the novelistic aspects, not to mention, questions of consistency across the works, for example, Second Discourse and Emile, make that project daunting. So I kind of wish he had written it. That said, I mean, it was Emil that got me to go to graduate school and become a professor. So I owe it to him, to it, I should say. See, now I've made him into a character too, in my own story.
I did wonder if there was a metatextual element in your writing. I mean, I was sort of looking for John Scott constructing the reader. So I had to.
John Scott had to go through all those stages of reading. John Scott thought that he was reading an educational treatise.
Right. If you rewrite this book, you could include yourself as a character.
That's right. And I think it's funny. I mean, again, the educational treatise, and you know, as a plug for Emil, there's a lot more work to be done on Rousseau's Emile, because it's been rather neglected, precisely because it does seem to appear as an educational treatise. And there's almost no worse scholarship on Rousseau than the educational people who think it's an educational treatise. And of course, people did. And I tell a couple of brief anecdotes of people writing to Rousseau saying, I'm going to raise my kid like this. And he's like, are you crazy? You know, this isn't meant to be an educational treatise. And Rousseau characterizes it as a book for the wise or philosophers, meant to teach that man is naturally good and corrupt in society, the fundamental core principle of thought. So somehow by showing the raising of Emile without sin being introduced or corruption being introduced, more language for him, he's able to prove that the source of vices, he claims, comes from outside, not from our nature. Well, so that's what the book is. It's not meant to be an educational treatise in any straightforward way.
Yeah. So if you could maybe sort of walk us through an example or two from this sort of dizzying number of examples in the text about Rousseau's strategy for educating the reader. I mean, I particularly am fond of the story about, you know, the gardener gardening moment where the tutor has Emil plant something or other, and then the gardener comes along and pulls it up, and it's revealed that you know, this is the gardener's after all. And in any case, the you know, feel free to sort of comment on that or any other to sort of bring out some of this the educative element to the reader.
Yeah, the gardener episode has always been one of my favorites as well. And I'm not really quite sure if I believe my own interpretation of it. but the general flavor is, at least I think, true. I make this point in the book, is I'm not trying to convince my reader that my interpretation of various episodes, and you're right, I use a number of them as illustrations, that my interpretation of every episode is correct. I think there's room to debate how to interpret these different episodes and lessons, et cetera, et cetera. My point is rather that you have to interpret them, that you have to ask certain questions of the episodes. So let me, I'll mention three, I guess, techniques that he uses, but I won't necessarily focus on, you know, each of them. One technique Rousseau uses persistently throughout the book is to have a comparison between Emil on the one hand, and usually it's your pupil, as though he's speaking to a fellow educator, your pupil and my pupil. And this is kind of like natural man and civil man in the second discourse. I think what they're meant to do is to test your progress. Do you think that your pupil, ordinary, corrupted little brat, is natural, or do you now agree with me that my pupil, Emil, is natural? Who's natural? Who's artificial? Who's a better representative of what human nature is? So there are constant comparisons like that throughout the book. And again, I think it's meant to test the progress of the reader, and the progress of reader, whether or not he or she is persuaded by Rousseau's account. So that's a fairly straightforward one. And oftentimes they come with these accusatory moments. You know, you think your pupil is natural? You know, put my book down. You're not worthy of reading it. You know, so these become the sort of accusatory moments oftentimes. Another technique that's a little bit more sophisticated basically, will the real Emil please stand up? So there are stories in the work where you presume it's Emil. But upon closer inspection, it's not clear that it is in fact Emil. And the Gardner episode is one, again, that I'm a little less sure of. One that's more obvious is when Jean-Jacques and Emile get lost in the forest. And they're hungry, and it's, you know, what time is it? Emile looks at his watch. It's noon. You know, God, I'm hungry. We will never find town. And they figure out how to get there from their astronomy lesson. And Emile, you know, is overjoyed to get lunch. And a little bit later, Rousseau says, Emile doesn't have a watch. You know, I gave myself what he says, an ordinary Emile for the purposes of the story. So any reader who didn't realize, why would Emile have a watch? And why would Emile get angry and upset? Because we're told that's not natural. Well, you just misread the story. You misread the story in supposing that this is, quote unquote, really Emile. Of course, then that leads you into this weird labyrinth as a reader, like, well, that's not the real Emile, as though Emile is real. So it has that strange effect of verisimilitude. And there are plenty of other stories, cake races, et cetera, where it's not, sometimes it's explicitly not Emile, and sometimes you're not sure if it's Emile or not. And one interesting thing about interpreters of Rousseau is most of them don't pay any attention to that. They assume that any story told in the work, including the cake races story of a proud, young, lazy kid, is Emile, but it's not. That's a complicated matter too. One other technique I'll just briefly mention is what I call, inept apologues. So an apologue being the moral of the story or of a fable, for example. Rousseau, of course, analyzes fables in the work and argues that oftentimes the lessons are the wrong ones that a child gets from reading the fable, or that the apologue, the moral of the story, is either unnecessary if the fable is clear, or inappropriate if it's not. So what I look at is a number of episodes where Rousseau says, well, the lesson of this episode is X. But you don't have to wait very far to figure out or think very hard to think, that can't possibly be the lesson I'm supposed to get from this little story. So for example, the cake races, this proud young child that Rousseau claims he once, educated for a few weeks or whatever it was. he was involved in this elaborate scheme of running races and getting cakes. And at the end, Rousseau says, well, the purpose was to make his visual compass accurate. He can accurately determine the best way to get to the cake. But that's not the moral of the story. The moral story is he's curing the child's pride. So if you as a reader think it was about training eyesight, you've misread the story. So again, another kind of challenge to the reader. So all these different techniques, I think, are meant to challenge, at bottom, meant to challenge the reader and assess the reader's progress.
I thought we could turn to the frontispieces to the Emile, because we've been talking about the frontispieces, and you have a whole chapter on the five different frontispieces for the five different books of the Emile. The first one, turn to it in my Bloom edition. Okay, so the first one from memory is Thetis dipping Achilles into the river Styx, right? Do I have that right?
To render him invulnerable.
And making him invulnerable. Of course, one of the things you point out is that, it's entitled Thetis. It's that Achilles is not mentioned. And also on top of this, it's not clear in what way Emile is made invulnerable in this educational treatise. If anything, he's made more vulnerable, right? So maybe you could talk about this frontispiece.
Yeah, I think that's another example of an inapt apologue, so to speak. If you were to talk to my students, they would all say, "Yeah, we spend half the class on all the illustrations, whatever we're reading, whether that be Hobbes, Leviathan." So Rousseau's not alone in using visual images like frontispieces, Hobbes being sort of the most obvious, or maybe Bacon, the new inspiration, showing a ship sailing through the Pillars of Hercules to represent going beyond what we've previously known. So Rousseau's not alone in doing this, but almost all of his major works have illustrations. And as I mentioned, he was very involved in the execution or the design of them. So the once free meal I've long been fascinated by. And I think, like probably most readers who thought it was an educational treatise, I sort of took it, you know, for granted. Oh, maybe I have a really sophisticated interpretation, like, oh, well, Emile is kind of a new Achilles. So it's kind of like Socrates and Plato. Socrates is now the new Hercules or Achilles, a new kind of form of hero. So now Emile is going to be a new form of hero. I don't think that's wrong, but it's not really very sufficient. So what struck me in looking at that frontispiece of the entire book, as well as book one, is how inappropriate it is. Achilles is, you know, he's invulnerable except for his heel, of course, but there's an attempt to make him invulnerable. And what's the result of that? He's one angry dude. You know, he does all kinds of really bad stuff in the Iliad because of his anger, the very first word of the poem, of the Iliad itself, wrath. So Achilles is the representation of wrath, of anger. And Emile, we're explicitly told, not just in the text itself, but on the title page itself, that anger is not natural. Because there's a quotation as the epigraph to the work from Seneca from On Anger. And so we're told anger is not natural, and that we have the natural resources in our psychology to not be angry. And yet the frontispiece shows the angriest person, other than that guy on the freeway trying to cut you off, that in you know, that there is. And so this is, seems like, wait a minute. This seems to be an entirely inappropriate image here. And then what I was led to, this is largely what the chapter is about, is to look at the picture, the illustration, in light of the textual place where it's referred to. And my suggestion is basically it's a dialogic type interpretive endeavor. You have to look at the illustration, look at the text, look back at the illustration, and you come to a new interpretation that's much more complex than the initial impression you get.
Frontispiece for the second book is Chiron educating Achilles. And I mean, one of the striking things about this frontispiece is that, you know, the weapons are thrown on the ground, right? It's a much more kind, you know, it's a kindler and gentler Achilles. So, you know, is this a continuation of that abstraction from anger or rejection of anger? Or how do you read this frontispiece?
Yes, and yes, I read it in part that way. And so the interesting thing I think about that one is that the textual reference to the frontispiece, the book two, is a story of this young, proud child running. And so Rousseau becomes Chiron in the example because he's teaching the young boy to run and get his cakes as a reward, but in order to cure his pride. So there is a really central aspect of Rousseau's argument about human nature, namely that pride is not natural. So the story of the young man being told is of someone who has been infected by pride, his status as a nobleman. So he's filled with social distinction and amour propre and all the things that Rousseau says are not natural. And the idea is to cure him of his pride through this elaborate running race episode. So likewise, we would want to cure Achilles of his anger or of his pride as well. But then if you think about it in terms of Emile doesn't need lessons in running races. First of all, he's running around like a little imp that he is. He's robust, you know, and so on. But he's certainly not angry or prideful. So Emile is a contrast to what's being told both in the story within the text about this proud young man and of the illustration itself. And I think you're right that the disarming of Achilles is meant to signal a kind of disarming of the anger and pride and so on and so forth that we take to be natural to us, but Rousseau argues is not.
The frontispiece of the third book is know, shifts away from the Achilles story. Mm-hmm. So that's a, you know, it's a kind of puzzle, but it concerns the arts and the sciences again. So this can, you know, bring us full circle about the art of writing and Rousseau's relationship to Plato's Phaedrus. So maybe you could sort of skip, you know, say a little bit about that. What we see in the third book's frontispiece and your reading of it.
Right. So the frontispiece shows Hermes engraving the elements of the sciences and arts on a column in order to make them permanent. And so it's another version of the Phaedrus story of bringing writing and other arts to mankind. I'll confess that until I realized that, book three was my least favorite book in a meal. I was kind of impatient, you know, get through it. I'm not really very interested in it. But then once I saw the Phaedrus connection, and again, the question of writing and speech and rhetoric and proper education through rhetoric, you know, the book became completely different for me as a reader. In this case, the textual reference is where Rousseau just blurts out, "I hate books." That's a quotation in English translation. "I hate books. They only teach you to, you know, et cetera, et cetera." And so there are going to be no books in Emile's library. Instead, he's going to learn sciences by, you know, Montessorian interaction or something that's, you know, anachronistic, but not inaccurate. No books. So again, you come back to the question of writing and the insufficiencies of writing a book, for example, as compared to speech. And then Rousseau has interesting things to say about speeches and rhetoric as well in the book. Of course, the exception is that Jean-Jacques is going to give Emile one book, Robinson Crusoe, which is, you know, is the subject of another chapter in the book. So there are books involved. So Emile might not need books except for perhaps Robinson Crusoe, but the reader of Emile most definitely needs a book, namely Emile, and it's meant to replace other books. And I suggest, of course, that the one book that he doesn't talk about that's obvious is the Bible.
Good. Yeah. And that's where I kind of wanted to close here with the last question about religion in the Emile. And so this sort of lumps together a number of your careful analyses. So sorry about the, you know, sort of the general question, but, you know, so there's in the book four, you know, there's the frontispiece of Orpheus. There is the famous profession, which is right before the profession of faith of the Sabaean vicar, which the placement of it is a little bit strange, right? All of a sudden you get this discussion of religion. And then on top of that, you point out your argument about what's the problem with Robinson Crusoe. You know, Robinson Crusoe is a great book for Emile, except for one thing, which goes unmentioned. But you argue that it's, you know, it has to do the religious character to it. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the, you know, this sort of the elements of religion in the Emile and what role it has in the education of the reader in these different episodes.
Sure. And by the way, just to, you know, future John is working on a book on Rousseau on religion. Actually, present John's working on it. Future John hopes to be holding it as a published work.
And be back on this podcast again.
Yeah. And by the way, I wrote my senior honors thesis on with Roger Masters on Rousseau and religion. And Rousseau and religion was a major part of my dissertation. So I just feel like I'm rewriting my senior honors thesis over and over again. In terms of the Rousseau's reader book, I decided I'm not going to try and take up the substance of religious teaching and so on and so forth, but more interested in the paratextual elements of, you know, where it sits in the book, why it's a separate section, why it's a different character, is sort of the more novelistic, if you will, and structural elements of it. So that's what I focused on there. I think it's a very vexed question. So, you know, there are a lot of interpreters who have simply taken the religious teaching being presented there in Book Four of Emile as, you know, Rousseau's own religious views or religious views that he's expressing to a meal, for example, or trying to persuade the reader of these views about religion. But it seems to me that that can't be right for a whole series of reasons, among them that Rousseau makes it a separate section of the work explicitly. Emile and Jean-Jacques are left behind. We have two new characters, a young boy who's run away from home and converted to Catholicism from Calvinism and finds himself in a foreign country, prey to, you know, lecherous priests and so on. And he's saved by this character, the Savoyard Vicar, and then learns a bit about the Savoyard Vicar's history. And then Savoyard Vicar has this long speech in which he reveals his sort of religious quest. What is, you know, who am I? What is God? What are my moral rules? And then in the second part of it, a critique of scripture. So, but it's all presented as a separate section explicitly of the work. After it's over, Rousseau resumes his voice as author, and we're back to Jean-Jacques and Emile. So the question is, what's the relationship between the explicitly separate section, the religious teaching, the profession of faith, etc., and all the paratextual narrative elements, on the one hand, to the text of Emile and the narrative of Emile on the other? So it's a very vexed question. My basic argument in terms of Rousseau's reader is we have another example of certain speeches are appropriate for different audiences. So schematically speaking, the vicar's speech would not be useful or appropriate for Emile, whereas it is appropriate for the character to whom it's given in the story. And it's meant to be to save his soul, to put it that way. He's a corrupted or semi-corrupted young man who needs religion as a bulwark for his happiness and his morality in a way that Emile does not need such a speech. We do not know what religious teaching Emile gets, if any. And so the assumption that, well, the profession is meant for him, just the structure of the whole book and story suggests it's not.
Great. Well, I wish we could continue down that not straight path, but beating the bushes around in the Savoyard Vicar. But, you know, we could be here for another couple hours. So
yeah, it's a complicated matter. Yeah.
It is, yeah. So let me say, you know, John, this has been a lot of fun. And, you know, so thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
I really appreciate it, Jeff. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.